Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, I'm Joe Paris, and our guest on this episode of State of Readiness is Donald Cook, continuous improvement expert extraordinaire. He started his continuous improvement journey in the 1990s at General Electric when he was personally selected by Jack Welch to join Jack and the select group of other senior leaders at GE in a very class to be trained in Six Sigma, taught by the original Six Sigma guru himself, Michael Harry. Since then, Donald has held senior leadership positions at J.P. Morgan, Chase, Computer Associates, AIG, BNY Mellon, and now Mednax, a leading healthcare provider in the States. Whether in the C-suite or reporting to the C-suite, his various positions' responsibilities included continuous improvement, operational excellence, quality, policy deployment, and business transformation. I'm sure you'll find his experiences, stories, and insights as fascinating as I did. Welcome, Donald.
Good morning, Joe, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's really a great pleasure in having you. And you know, reading through your history, you know, you've got flowing robes. You know, you are the Ben Kenobi of OpEx and continuous improvement. And it's really a great pleasure having you on board, and I look forward to you sharing your wisdom with me and the wider audience at large.
Thank you so much. Happy to do it. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've been doing this for quite some time, and I believe your start was at GE when you first really did a deep dive into continuous improvement and Six Sigma specifically with Michael Harry, who you may or may not know has passed away a year or two ago.
Yeah, that was a very interesting time. I was, in fact, recruited to the lab at General Electric to lead business transformation from the perspective of deploying new technology from the lab out into the GE businesses. And we had about 200 patents in a portfolio in all different areas of science that we wanted the businesses to apply. And we were just not getting any traction. So the laboratory manager, Lonnie Edelheit, and Jack got together and said, let's just put this guy out into the field. We'll have him work for each of the different business GMs and see what is in our way. Let's go find out why we are not getting the traction that we need. And I met with each of the different business GMs from GE Capital, Equity Capital, GE Finance, NBC, plastics, aircraft engines, locomotives, light bulbs, the entire spectrum of GE's portfolio. And to a person, they said, we're struggling with globalization. The reason we can't open that briefcase with all the new technology in it is that it would be like Pandora's box around here. We've got processes that we're transferring to China, Mexico, Japan, and elsewhere globally, and those suppliers aren't capable. They're not able to reproduce what we are building today, let alone all the new advanced stuff that you have in that briefcase. So until we solve that problem, we can't move forward. And I came back with that message to Mr. Welch and Lonnie. And very skillfully, Jack was always a gifted analyst and gifted leader and moved quickly on evidence. He didn't analyze things. He moved quickly to bring Michael Harry, who wrote the book on Six Sigma, to Crotonville, to the Executive Training Center in Crotonville, New York. And along with Jack and his direct reporting staff, he handpicked one senior executive manager from each of the different GE businesses and myself among all of the PhDs, among the 1,700 PhDs across all of GE's R&D centers in India, in each of the different GE businesses, in the R&D center in Niskayuna, New York. I was the very first chosen for Master Black Belt training and certification with Jack and his staff. So it was really quite an exciting time because we were deploying something that was very new across the entire enterprise.
So, I mean, this is not your first introduction to continuous improvement, though. I mean, you met another great and studied under another great, Dr. Edward Deming.
Absolutely. That's an interesting point and may have been a contributor to my being selected to be the first Master Black Belt at GE. I did study statistics under Dr. Deming at George Washington University. And Dr. Deming was brilliant and was a very skillful instructor, and he would bring the class together. He had a funny expression: if people seemed to diverge from the topic or couldn't answer his question, in a very dry voice, he would say, "And we're off to the Milky Way." And in that way, you knew that you weren't meeting the topic. But he gave us a really strong foundation of statistics applied in an operational setting and in a manufacturing production setting. So I began with Deming-based statistics in production optimization and leverage that with Dr. Michael Harry. I mean, there are three people that are spoken about, I think, in our age that have had dramatic impact on operational excellence, one being Dr. Deming, of course, being the founder of statistical process management on an enterprise-wide basis. The Deming Award is the highest quality award that's given in Japan, as people may know. Dr. Michael Harry, who wrote the book on Six Sigma, and Taichi Ono, who brought Lean into existence. And I've been blessed and gifted, actually, by knowing and studied under two of the three people that are most well-known for success in leadership in that area.
Outstanding, outstanding. And after you graduated, now, when you're at GE, and Michael Harry was conducting his coursework. And we talk about alignment and commitment of senior management to these endeavors. My understanding is that Jack Welch actually participated full-time in these classes along with you and the other students. Is that correct?
Absolutely, he did. And Jack was quite an inspiration to the leadership team at GE because he was fully immersed in the management of the business. And so if he was declaring that there was a new initiative, a new target, something that needed to be done, he stood at the front line. I remember a movie about fighting in Vietnam, and the instructor says to the group, the leader says, "My boot will be the first to touch the battlefield, and my boot will be the last to leave." And Jack had that kind of courageous leadership style. He and his direct reporting staff took the leadership course, the Six Sigma Master Black Belt course under Michael.
And after you your stint at General Electric, then you went on to J.P. Morgan Chase, and well, before even that, Telexis Communications, but then J.P. Morgan Chase, as Senior Vice President of OpEx and Business Transformation. And, you know, you went from General Electric, and were you involved in their GE Finance? Or, you know, how did you go from GE to J.P. Morgan?
That's a good question. You know, I was very fortunate at GE, working across GE's businesses. I created their standardized metric portfolio with KPIs, SLAs for the vendors. I created the product life costing model for the enterprise and managed the enterprise-wide quality and supplier council. So I had good reach into the different GE businesses, but as I got toward the back end of my engagement with GE, Jack and his team asked if the principles that had been applied in manufacturing that we had applied so well in transportation systems and lighting. You may know, if you look at my legacy, you'll see that I have patents and copyrights for things that I know absolutely nothing about because I was tasked with making dramatic change and improvement in an impossibly short time frame using the tools and methods. And so Jack said, can you do something with GE Finance and Equity Capital? And I did. I applied the same tools and methods with equal success and became a member of the M&A, the merger and acquisition analysis team, so that as they were doing due diligence, I would travel with the team to visit the sites and locations that they were looking to acquire or invest in, and I would analyze what improvement we could make post-acquisition if we applied Lean Six Sigma in that enterprise. So we were modeling and predicting the post-acquisition improved value using and deploying Lean Six Sigma with great success. I remember one summer I toured Italy for a gentleman by the name of Paolo Fresco, whose name may be familiar to you because he was the country manager for all of Italy for GE, and I worked across all of his key merger and acquisition sites. We bought three companies out of the group that were very successful and went on to great success at GE. And he became, I think, the president of Ferrari, Fiat Ferrari organization. So we went from manufacturing to finance to equity capital, and J.P. Morgan Chase ran into an issue with a failed regulatory audit, an internal audit in a B2B business in Maitland, Florida, and Sandy Warner, who was Jack's chairman of the board and president of J.P. Morgan Chase, president of J.P. Morgan at the time, said, "Who do we have that can walk on water and turn this thing around in 90 days?" I said, and Jack said, "I've got your guy." And I was hired and recruited to be the first senior vice president of transformation and operational excellence in the history of J.P. Morgan Chase, and was equally successful applying the same tools and methods. We turned that business around, added over $1.2 billion in new revenue, and shortened the cycle time for the execution of these large luxury loans, these commercial B2B loans and bundled brokered loans, from what had been running 42 to 43 days on average to less than 10 days from registration to funding. So it had a huge impact on the business.
And then how long were you at J.P. Morgan?
Roughly 2.5 years. The journey was an exciting one. We not only turned around the B2B business, but the redesign of the customer contact center that we created for that operation became the blueprint for the entire enterprise, and I redeployed that technology nationally in Walnut Creek, California, Cleveland, Ohio, of course, Maitland, Florida, which was the original site, and Rochester, New York. So we redeployed the technology everywhere with equal success. And the toolbox and methods that we developed there became the standard toolbox and analytics for all of J.P. Morgan Chase. When J.P. Morgan Chase held their first Lean Six Sigma conference at One Chase Plaza, in the basement of One Chase Plaza, the then president, Steve Rotella, brought everyone together, all of the advocates and all the participants in the program, and gave them my toolbox. He was the keynote presenter, and I immediately followed him to introduce the toolbox, the method, and we redeployed it, copyrighted it to make it culturally relevant and maturity sensitive to where J.P. Morgan Chase was at that time in their journey, and then created a new toolbox and method that we could redeploy at Chase. So it was a very exciting journey.
So after J.P. Morgan, you made another industry change. You know, we started off with, you know, GE and industry. We went to J.P. Morgan and finance, and then you ended up here, or ended up at CA Technologies as the Vice President of Worldwide Transformation and Operational Excellence, Quality and Policy Deployment. That must have been a big business card.
It was a big business card, and it was there were very big shoes to fill. As you may know, the company at that time had been identified with some Security and Exchange Commission reporting anomalies and had been put under control of an independent examiner that was provided by Wall Street, by the SEC, in order to turn the company around. And we had a very short fuse. I think we had a six-month window in which to completely turn around the regulatory escapes of the company. And I think you say it well. The challenge is going from making light bulbs and aircraft engines to redesigning a $4 billion commercial B2B business at Chase to now turning around the fourth largest software company in the world, those are pretty big gear shifts. That's sort of like going from first to fifth. But as I would share with the audience, the toolbox and the method is equally relevant and equally appropriate. So don't ever let your prior success stand in the way of who you can become. If you know your craft well and you believe in yourself, there's no reason that you can't reapply that toolbox and method in a completely new setting. And in record short time, we set aside the deferred prosecution agreement with the SEC. It was not a coincidence that Lee Richards, the attorney that was the representative for and the independent examiner for the group, had an office next to mine, and we had a very close working relationship. I grow to have a profound respect for Lee and our senior-most counsel at the time, who was managing the relationship from a legal perspective, Pat Nazzo, who has become very famous in Washington, D.C., in exactly that same setting. He was gifted, and it was an honor to work with him. John Swainson, who I believe was the past president of IBM Canada, and that team and group at the time, we went from one end of the enterprise to the other, mapping all of the business processes, and then we initially concentrated on redesigning a coherent, simultaneous book close budgeting and forecasting process to address the regulatory non-compliances. And immediately following that, we marched through the organization, because we were also, talk about an exciting transformation, in the very moment that we were transforming the enterprise in order to address regulatory issues, we were also installing SAP. So we did those all simultaneously. I mean, that's any one of those things could be a career compromising challenge if one didn't have great faith and confidence and trust in the team and the method. But we did them all simultaneously, and I learned the value of rapid process prototyping and simultaneous process and technology change out. And now in my view, in my heart and mind, they are inseparable. Whenever I look at a transformational initiative, I don't look at technology as an enabler and as a standalone set of technical challenges. And process reengineering and operational and manufacturing process and quality control as a separate set of objectives. I see them to be coherent, simultaneous, and we do them at the same time and deliver them in about 40% less time and about 50% less cost.
With the short fuse there, as you said, at CA, and you said trust, you had a team that there was a lot of mutual trust. How did you establish that trust so quickly? Because usually trust is based on experience and predictability. It seemed in this case at CA, it was granted. So explain that a little bit.
It was and it wasn't. That's very insightful. And it shows me, Joe, that you too have been in this exact same environment with the same journey. The challenge is that being an outsider, someone that's not, that does not have a legacy with the company, that's unknown to the company, that's brought in as a subject matter expert, it would be easy and convenient for the company to be dismissive of my thoughts and ideas because they're not the old way of doing things. I heard while I was there and we were deploying the SAP, doing the SAP deployment and the controls redesign for the SEC, I heard the expression among the group that even the expression "not invented here" had been invented there. So you can imagine there was a fair degree of resistance to change, but we overcame it by working very closely as a senior leadership team. It takes active participation by the president and the CEO to move the company forward. And John Swainson was gifted. He was brilliant in that endeavor. He worked very closely with all of the different business units and all the teams to inspire them to change and made it not optional. Said, look, the transformation is going to happen. You're going to get on this bus or you're going to be under the bus. But one way or the other, we're moving. The company is going to be moving quickly. We have to. We got into this unusual predicament with the regulatory issues. And in some ways, that actually helped us to overcome resistance to change. John's visionary leadership, his active participation, his weekly sound bites and virtual meetings with teams to keep everybody apprised of the changes, the monthly town hall meetings that he held. We would do live video broadcast town hall meetings to the world from the central office in Islandia with a professional television crew, and we would walk the teams that had delivered the best results with their OPEX programs and their quality programs and their technology change programs. We would walk them across the stage, and he would shake their hand and celebrate their success. So he created a celebratory environment for change where people were rewarded for making that move forward. It was very active leadership. And it was incredibly successful. In retrospect, I certainly couldn't have done it alone. It was a fully engaged partnership and teamwork. The same was true at J.P. Chase. I mentioned earlier that I began the journey with Steve Rotella. At the back end of my journey, Chase was sold to Bank One. Bank One, I believe, had deeper pockets, so their leadership team prevailed. And I ended up working for Jamie Dimon. And worked for Jamie at Chase, who was equally gifted and just an amazing leader. So I have to share that if I have a legacy of success, it's because I have worked with some of the brightest and most gifted mentors and leaders and business leaders of our age.
So I got to ask, how do you do that? How do you get to meet these people? It sounds like it all started with Jack, and then it was a series of introductions.
It did, and Jack and his team and the leadership team at GE brought me forward with all of their projects into their next roles and responsibilities. At GE, I worked most closely, of course, I reported to Lonnie Edelheit, who was the, I think, Senior Vice President of Global R&D for GE. But as I was deployed out to the field at Medical Systems and Healthcare, I worked for Jeff Immelt, who became the president of the company, John Breen, who was the general manager of lighting, Dave Cody, who was the general manager of appliances, who ultimately went on to become the president of Honeywell, John Rice, who managed at the time GM of Transportation Systems, became the vice chairman, Bob Nardelli, of course, very successful managing PowerGen as the general manager of PowerGen and then going on to becoming the president of Chrysler Corporation and of Home Depot. And, of course, just the honor and privilege of being mentored and working with Jack Welch and his direct reporting team at the beginning very closely with Gary Reiner as we deployed the program. These were brilliant and amazing people. And they have largely carried me forward in my career. So when Chase needed help, they reached out to me to see if we couldn't improve operational effectiveness because of that referral.
But, you know, we're not done yet, right? Because after CA, you went on to AIG as their Enterprise Transformation Change Agent. You know, so here we are going yet again to insurance companies. You know, the industries just keep on getting wider and wider.
Absolutely. And now we're in insurance, which is a completely different domain, very different business model, different goals and objectives, and the tools and methods were equally successful there as well. And as you may know, AIG had its own issues, was facing its own challenges with respect to regulatory and compliance issues. And I was asked to come aboard the team and support them. First, as a rapid deployment subject matter expert in McKinsey Five Lenses and Lean Six Sigma deployment across the enterprise, working for a company called NTT Data. AIG didn't have open headcount at the time, but needed my help, so they brought me through a consulting firm. And then immediately, once the headcount became available, hired me out of my contract at NTT Data as a direct report. We worked globally.
Now, I would imagine that the experience at J.P. Morgan in finance, a lot of that is transferable to the insurance companies, you know, the AIG.
It is. It is. And the same forensic auditing techniques and the same time of day, day of week, demand and capacity analysis techniques where we heat map throughput and demand for different events. It turns out that all of the different events in insurance, as you might guess, and banking are anti-cyclical. They don't all occur at the same time. Events in retail banking occur at different times of the day than events in commercial banking, and they're seldom coincidental. So by studying the behavior, the client and customer behavior, and how it is similar in some cases, but mostly unique, we then design and build the processes that are highly optimized to provide those services at the time of day in which those customers and clients want to be served. So instead of designing a customer contact center with steady state 9-to-5 staffing, assuming that people want to talk to us from 9-to-5, we do detailed analysis, time of day analysis, and event analysis for things like insurance sales or banking and retail banking visits, and find out when the demand really occurs and when people want to be helped, so that we're focusing our teller support at the time of the day when people really want to step up to the teller. And in the same way, the customer contact center, when people want to be sold insurance. And then we highly optimize the operating center. Without going into any of the details, I can tell you that we had a huge, almost a 50% efficiency gain in the sell-through in one of these institutions just by changing the time of day and the behavior and the scripting of the way we interacted with the customer and client by studying their behavior, their needs and desires, and then building and designing the process around those.
So voice, classic voice of the customer stuff.
Absolutely. Very, very, with a capital V.
Right.
Really very laser-focused on the needs and interests of the customer, and even how they wanted to be reached. So that we looked at the demographics of the customer, the products and services that they already had from us, if they had a history. We immediately put it on the screen in front of the operator so the operator knew exactly who they were talking to. And people that were professionals, attorneys, doctors, and others, we addressed them as professionals. Yes, Dr. Smith, thank you for calling. It's good to speak with you again. How can I help you? And all of a sudden, it becomes a very personal conversation. It becomes a very intimate conversation with the customer where the customer's needs are being delivered with laser precision and guidance. And we even learned to make outgoing sales calls and renewal calls at exactly the time of the day, the window of time in which we had the best sell-through. I can tell you on Tuesday morning, if we called at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, we had something like 14% sell-through. If we called at 4:30 in the afternoon on the same Tuesday to exactly the same group of customers, took the same phone numbers and just called them back at the time of day in which they wanted to be talked to, we had 81% sell-through. Well, it doesn't take a lot of imagination. Why don't we call them when they want to buy things? Let's call them when people really want to do business with us, and we'll staff the center to be able to accommodate all the volume that we need to support at precisely that moment, so we don't waste 15,000 phone calls between 9 and noon when no one wants to buy the product.
Right. And then you moved on to BNY Mellon. Now, your role, the role of the bank is different than, say, J.P. Morgan Chase. And your role there as chief process architect was a little bit different than the previous.
It was, and this was another reference from within GE. The gentleman that I worked for there was one of the 8 original or 9 original master black belts that trained with me at GE. So here's, this goes all the way back to, if we think about that referral network of highly networked, profoundly respectful and successful people, I got a phone call out of the blue that said, we could really use your help. We've been laboring with the deployment of an enterprise architecture. We've got a structured group of APIs, but they're not closely coupled with the technology or the process. We've got 19,000, imagine this number, 19,000 process maps at all different levels with no standard taxonomy, no governance, no age control, no revision control. So we might have six different versions of the same map and no one knows which one is the newest and most accurate process map. And we had a technology architecture with all of the platforms and all of the connectivity. The technology architecture was probably the most mature. The process architecture was the least mature. So the enterprise asked me to come aboard and deploy a three-dimensional architecture that linked the processes under governance and control with tiered access, 60,000 users to those 19,000 maps, tiered access to the architecture with structured taxonomy, definitions, and connectivity between the APIs, the technology, the processes that used them, and the data collection nodes for all the process controls in between. So we now had a three-dimensional view, if you will, of the architecture that could reveal for us the behavior of the business and tell us in real time when we were achieving periods of peak demand, because as you suggested, BNY Mellon is a completely different type of institution. It's an investment institution and a central bank to the world's central bank. So it has a different behavioral model than Chase. But similarly, as we've discussed before, the tools and methods are equally applicable and equally successful in that method. In the first 6 months, I was able to deploy the platform, create and provide the standard language and taxonomy that converted all of these different data elements and data sets from the process to the technology to the APIs to the data collection nodes. And then as a result of having three-dimensional view of the demand across the network that was now visible through this tool and this BPM process management tool, wrote the sustainability plan for the enterprise. As you may know, the institution had just suffered a hurricane in New York City. That was the time window in which I was at BNY Mellon.
Sandy, right?
Hurricane Sandy. And to better prepare the institution for future business down events and to predict and model the outcomes of every conceivable malady and issue, from pestilence to literally labor walkouts. If the labor became unavailable, where would we move the business? How could we ensure business portability and process portability across geographic boundaries and maintain the strict controls and the transparency that everyone at the institution so greatly respected? So that's that was the nature of the role, and did it in record short time, simply because I had a very mature toolbox that was ready to deploy. In every case, I take everything that I've learned. I now have about 300 different analytical tools and methods in my OpEx toolbox and business transformation toolbox that include change and performance management, include capability assessment, capacity assessment, cost and quality assessment, productivity down to individual transactions, and brought that forward in every case and reapplied it to the uniqueness and the needs of the customers, clients, and the company.
Remarkable, remarkable. Listen, we're going to take a break and then come back in a few moments. You're listening to State of Readiness with Joseph Paris and our guest, Donald Cook.
Thank you, Joe.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Readiness Institute. the leading education center for companies who want to create an organization that recognizes time as the enemy of the 21st century company and knows the competitive advantage will go to the company that can see further beyond the horizon, recognize opportunities and threats more quickly, has achieved a superior level of operational excellence, and possesses the organizational capacity and capability to devise and deploy decisive responses faster than the competition and even the marketplace, all the while maintaining control of the narrative, and has become the high-performance organization. Welcome back. This is State of Readiness with Joseph Paris, and our guest today is Donald Cook. Donald, you know, we've talked about several senior roles that you've had, which would be more than most people would have in two career lifetimes. But this latest stint actually calls back to your earlier days when you were in the U.S. Air Force Medical School at Shepherd Air Force Base, and you earned your certification as a surgical emergency medical technician. So, you know, if we haven't, you know, really covered just about everything that a person could cover in a lifetime, you know, shy of being a fighter pilot also, that's not in your repertoire, is it?
No.
Okay, so now we're at Mednax, which is one of the largest healthcare providers in the United States, and your role there is a chief transformation officer in operational excellence. So how did you make that transition?
Similarly, I was recruited to the role from someone that knew my background, knew well that I had a medical background, that I managed emergency medicine at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 4 years. So after coming out of surgical school as an EMT, I went to Wright-Patterson during the midst of the war, and at that time people were rotating a year stateside and then they'd go offshore, they'd go into the theater, and then they'd come back for a year and be given the opportunity to re-up, if you will.
Well, just to put a context in this, what theater are we talking about?
Vietnam. This was during the midst of the Vietnam War.
Okay, so,
And so all of my contemporaries, everybody that went through medical school with me, went their very first tour to Vietnam, and under somewhat unusual circumstances, for some reason, I was recruited to go to Air Force Logistics Command and to manage emergency medicine. And Logistics Command headquarters was Wright-Patt. So there were lots of aircraft, lots of pilots, a lot of flight surgical team members, some of the best health care that the Air Force could provide. And I managed emergency medicine so successfully that I never left the base. I never toured away. I never spent time in Vietnam, and I spent all of my time at Wright-Patt. And knowing that I had this hands-on healthcare administration background, I do my own fracture and dislocation reduction, administer my own meds, digital blocks, intubate patients. My cardiac resuscitation team had the best success rate in the hospital, so we covered the first three floors of the hospital in cardiac resuscitation events. So we became highly skilled in the administration of medicine, and when Mednax said we would like someone as a Lean Six Sigma practitioner to also be aware of the uniquenesses of healthcare and medical practice, other than finding a licensed physician that was also a Lean Six Sigma certified transformation change agent, they would have been hard-pressed to find someone with the mix of background that I had to bring to that relationship.
So you were able to, you know, to walk in there with a at least a familiarity of what is going on and what the needs were and what some of the challenges they might be facing. What kind of resistance did you, as an outsider, you know, coming from finance, coming from all, you know, GE, what kind of resistance did you encounter coming into Mednax, and how did you overcome that?
The resistance was relatively high. The company had been in business for 40 years and had never had a transformational event or moment, so the resistance to change was high. But recognizing that I had a medical background, I adjusted the conversation around the transformation to the language of medicine. So when we talked about KPIs, we didn't use the expression key performance indicators among the doctors. They couldn't relate to it. I converted the conversation to vital signs. So the metrics and KPIs were the company's vital signs. And now that I began to speak the language of medicine, one, they respected my background as a medical professional, but also the fact that I could convert my language and the language of Lean Six Sigma into the language of medicine that they knew so well.
Yeah, so I find that as a challenge in businesses when they start talking in Japanese, you know, the Gemba and Kaizen events. And to me, not speaking in the language, the vernacular of the person, the counterparty, immediately puts up barriers.
It does. It absolutely does.
And it almost makes it, instills a class system. I see lean individuals go in, they immediately start talking about, in Japanese or Japanese terms. And what it does is it sets them, in the eyes of their counterparty, sets them, at a different plane, almost with a degree of arrogance. You don't know Kaizen, so I'm going to teach you Kaizen, and then you'll be one of us. I will elevate you. Instead of just saying, listen, we're going to do a project that's going to improve stuff,
Sure, and we're here to help you.
And we're here to help you, right.
I always declare in every setting, in all of the roles through GE, Chase, BNY Mellon, AIG, I always declare when I meet new teams that I work for them. I say, good morning, I'm Donald Cook. I'm the Chief Transformation Officer, and I work for you. And I look them in the eyes when I say it, and I mean it, so that there's no gap or distance, and there's no arrogance about the fact that I'm bringing a completely different skill set than what is likely to be found within the enterprise. And in that way, can bring to light whole new standards. We developed entirely new standards for measuring the medical practice that included the number of patients that were being seen on a daily basis by each of the different doctors and each of the different specialties. And in the same way that we did heat mapping in the call center and heat mapping at the teller window at the bank, we did heat mapping for patient care and looking at healthcare. When do people want to be treated? What day of the week? What day of the month? What time of day, when are we most likely going to have people in different demographics not show up? So we're very strategic about our over-scheduling to take advantage of when we believe, and historically we predict with high accuracy, when people are likely to miss an appointment, so we don't waste the physician's time or the clinician's time if they're there to get a study. This allows us to densify, if you will, the workday, and very strategically, without over-scheduling, so people now have to be jammed into shorter windows of time for the services we provide, be sure that we always have patients available to be seen when we have an opening available in the schedule.
Now, what are some of the challenges? I mean, I know challenges that I've experienced in healthcare. The inefficiencies that abound. People thinking that from a consultancy perspective, consultants thinking that they can treat medicine and healthcare as if it was an exact science, like assembly lines on an assembling an automobile. And once you get into the operating theater, it's a black box. I mean, there's things you could do to prepare, and there's things you can do to in your after action, but during the process, it doesn't get as prescriptive as it is on the automobile assembly line. So how does a lean expert recognize they have to make that adjustment, or do you think they have to make an adjustment at all?
No, I think it's very important, and again, it reflects your insightfulness here, Joe, that this is a people business. We're not selling products and services. We're selling improved health and recovered health. And as you may know, the demands on the healthcare system are dramatic. The Affordable Care Act dramatically changed the landscape of healthcare in the United States, and suddenly we're treating an entirely new group of patients that haven't had health care, in some cases had been denied health care for many years, are now being treated and seen with, tragically, in some cases, grave health care issues, which is why they may not have been seen in the past. If they had a pre-existing condition, they weren't insurable in the past and sadly suffered badly with their maladies, now given the demands of the ACA, people are getting better coverage and better support. But it does create different demands on the healthcare system, because many of those same patients that may be underinsured or underprotected become non-payers. So the number of delinquencies is up by an order of magnitude. The number of non-pay is up by an order of magnitude. So suddenly we have to find ways of accommodating the non-reimbursing patients in the healthcare system.
Right. You know, I always say that it's not a matter of insurance. It's a matter of getting the cost of healthcare delivery under control.
Absolutely.
If we, insurance is just an aggregate of what is going to be paid out versus what is being collected by from the insured. And, if we can manage, as the industry, if the healthcare industry can better manage how much it costs to deliver that healthcare, the insurance cost would go down and everybody could be insured.
Absolutely agree. And that certainly has been my focus at Mednex and will continue to be the company's focus into the foreseeable future, is how do we improve operational effectiveness and efficiency in every aspect of the enterprise. It's not just the provision of healthcare, it's how do we manage revenue cycle management? How do we manage the billing process? How do we manage medical recruiting and onboarding? How do we support and sustain those activities over time and improve their productivity so that the cost per function and cost per transaction continues to decline over time, so we can generate more revenue, generate more margin for the enterprise.
It's not even about margin; it's just increased productivity.
Absolutely.
You have the resources, you have the apparatus. It's just better planning of its utilization. When not to use it. We don't, just because it's there doesn't mean we have to use it in every instance. So just a better management of the overall inputs to drive the desired outputs.
Absolutely agree. Couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at cycle time efficiencies, it's a brand new area, I think, for healthcare, and Mednex is not unique to it, but looking at how long it takes us to do these different events. If it takes 65 days to do 4 hours worth of work, that has to have impact upon the entire life cycle event of the patient care provision, because that's borne everywhere. That increased cost and that delinquency is carried throughout the revenue cycle. When do we finally get to recover the monies from the patient and all the insurance companies and the federal government and local and state governments, all the people that are participating in support of the patient? When do those monies finally come together, and when do we get reimbursement to the best of our ability?
Yeah. All right. So why don't we begin wrapping up here, and I'm going to ask you just a couple of questions. Just to connect you with the audience a little bit. And you've met a lot of pretty amazing people during your career there, Don. And looking back, and I know that it's going to be difficult, but what one leader do do you look to up to most, and why?
I've had so many, and each being a leader in their field, it's a very difficult choice. But certainly I think I respect Mr. Welch and his leadership. He was such an engaged leader. He fully understood the implications of every decision that he made, and he stood fast in them and expected people to deliver what they promised and what they told him. And in many ways, that leadership method is absolutely unique. I see, as we go deeper into my career, as we get further away from that time in history, I see the leaders thinking about, well, I wonder what people are going to think about this decision. I wonder what people are going to think about me. I wonder what they're going to think about my leadership. Jack said at the end of our days together, it won't have mattered if we didn't do the right thing. I really don't care what they think about me. I want them to deliver the right result for the enterprise. And I think his success speaks for itself.
Thank you for that. And one last question. What's a personal habit that contributes to your success? I mean, you've obviously been quite successful, quite blessed in your professional journey. What is a personal habit that has contributed to that?
I have great faith. Thank you, Joe, for the question. I have great faith that in every day and every moment, the work chosen for my hands and my heart and the work that I do in the world was chosen for a purpose, was chosen because I could contribute to this work and be successful with it. And because of that faith, I have equal faith, not only in myself, my ability to deliver what I'm asked for, even in cases where things were clearly impossible. Jack would send me to fix things that had been broken for years that no one, all the king's horses and all the king's men and women, had failed to deliver a solution, and yet they asked me to go do something impossible and said, we need the answer now, we know it sounds difficult, and we had to create new science to get it. But I believed that I was there for a purpose, and for that reason, I also had profound faith and trust in my team members and believed in them, that we were there together for a purpose, that life was a team sport, and that we were there to play it well together. And I can say with great pride that among the 900 black belts and master black belts that I have certified in my time in this operational excellence domain and in the quality domain and transformation domain, most have gone on to great success in their careers and have largely become known for their leadership success as well. So there's probably something good about the method that inspires people to step up every day.
Well, thank you very much for that, Don. Don Cook, everybody, continuous improvement expert extraordinaire. Thank you for joining us today, Donald.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.